You pressed play on this podcast with the click of curiosity. It is another dimension, a dimension of mind, a dimension where nothing is sacred and everything is explainable. You're streaming into a land of both inside and outside, of things and ideas. You've just crossed over into the midside.
Welcome to the midside, where when we take a great leap forward, we're playing Frogger. I'm your host, Justin M. Lesneski, and the state of the midside is fully realized. Years ago, yes, clap, let's applaud. That's it. Finally, in the state of the midside, people clapped on good lines, which I appreciate that the first line is a good line. But the clapping's distracting now, so you can stop. No? Okay. No, years ago when we started this show, Witness the Farce was sort of like a cool little in-joke if you read Atlas Shrugged. And it was sort of like, hey, this is how we should deal with it. But I feel like personally, I finally reached the point where I embody, because I truly understand what witnessing the farce means. For instance, this morning I was laying in bed and I was scrolling through Twitter for one of the first times this year. And I was reading all the stuff people were arguing about. And the stuff people were getting upset about, like Harley Quinn being an anti-villain. And then there was the normal race stuff. And I was reading it, and I didn't take it seriously. It was all just a complete joke to me. Not to say that, you know, I've become the comedian in Watchmen. I still very much am the Rorschach. But that is what we don't take seriously. The comedian didn't take everything seriously. But now I have really learned the importance of, through this show and through the interaction with you, the midsiders out there, how to really embody witnessing the farce and not taking things seriously and just laughing. I laugh at random times now and people are just like, why are you laughing? And they don't understand it. And then I explain it and they get it after a long circuitous discussion. But when I just start laughing in the moment, people don't understand it anymore. So thank you, Midsiders. Welcome to any new Midsiders out there. And if you want to help other people have this healthy reaction, tell a friend about our show. Joining me this trip from our nation's capital, Daniel T. Richards.
Okay. The State of the Union, by the way, did you watch it, Justin?
No.
Okay, that's for the best. I ducked out at mercantilism once he proposed an economic policy from before Adam Smith was born. I decided I no longer needed to watch it. But the clapping has gotten out of hand, you could say. But he did something interesting.
Wait. Hold on, I'm just trying to figure that one out.
The clapping got out of hand.
I know. I used a funny metaphor for clapping. Okay. He did something interesting, though. And it's one of these times when you think, is Donald Trump just dumb, or is he playing, 6D chess or whatever it is, interdimensional chess? And that is, he knew that the left, particularly the women in white, would not be clapping for any of his policies, including things like lowest black unemployment rate in history, lowest Latino unemployment rate in history,
lowest... Now, Latinx.
Whatever Donald Trump would say, yes, employment rate in history, didn't clap for World War II veterans, etc. But he
called out...
Wait, they
didn't clap for World War II veterans?
I think a couple disparately did, but on collective, they did not. They did not clap for the World War II veterans.
There's got to be a line. Like, I appreciate the showmanship of, like, we're all going to be white, and we're not going to clap for the guy we think's a dick. But come on, there's got to be a line. Like, World War II veterans, that's got to be a line.
Nope, womp. But... that's the kind of the point that I'm going to make, is that he got them to clap for one thing and one thing only, which is when he said there are now
really
more...
Really like The Handmaid's Tale on Hulu?
Close. He said there are now more women in Congress than any time since women had the right to vote, and they stood up and applauded themselves and high-fived themselves. And so you have this visual now of these Democrats, especially these protesting women, who... didn't applaud for low unemployment, didn't applaud for World War II veterans, but applauded the crap out of themselves. I think that's somewhat brilliant. I don't know if it's savant brilliant, if it's strategic brilliant, or if it's accidentally brilliant, but I do think it's somewhat brilliant.
No, I think he did it on purpose. I mean, look, say what you will about the man, there's one thing he knows what to do, and it's to make the left make fools of themselves.
Could be. I thought that was politics at its most strategic right there.
Also joining us from Dale's lawn, identifying as a woman to forgo his white male gay privilege, William Green.
Hello, hello. So, yeah, I too thought the stand up, sit down, fight, 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 it was very Catholic churchy, the State of the Union. It's getting worse and worse.
Podcat.
Yeah, it was very Catholic churchy. I agree. I mean, the government has become the new religion, right? We've talked about that over and over again on this show.
Yeah, absolutely. It was crazy, and this I do not approve of the massive applause of the leader of the United States. No one deserves that much applause, especially a politician who is probably net bad. Not just him, just no politician.
Okay, I was going to say 35,000 people in Gillette Stadium might disagree with you.
Yes, agreed. So, no politician at least deserves that.
And well, we know why they don't deserve it, so let's share it with people in the news with Daniel T. Richards.
Well, I assure you, Mr. Listener, it really is that bad. These aren't harmless criminals. Isn't just a fad.
Some of America's new representatives may be socialists, but here at the Midside, we're still hardcore capitalists. So we want to shout out to all of our Patreon subscribers, who we greatly appreciate. That helps us keep the lights on here. If you're unfamiliar, patreon.com/themidside allows you to give us a few bucks every time we do this show, help us pay for like hosting and website registration and ads and stuff, and we really appreciate it. You get exclusive content there too, just for Midside Patreon subscribers, midside.com/Patreon. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and others released the Green New Deal this week, basically, which is a roadmap for fighting climate change, quote-unquote spurring economic growth, and improving social welfare, alongside the 5-page non-binding resolution, co-sponsored by 9 senators and more than 60 House Democrats. Ocasio-Cortez's office published a 6-page document of Green New Deal talking points. These are essentially FAQs, which laid out what the policy is intending to do. So, for instance, net zero carbon emissions by 2030. That is moving America to 100% clean and renewable energy, ensuring a just transition for all communities and workers to ensure economic security for people and communities that have historically relied on fossil fuel industries, ensuring justice and equity for frontline communities by prioritizing investment, training, climate and community resiliency, economic and environmental benefits in these communities, a guaranteed job for anyone who is unable or, and I'm quoting here, unwilling to work. Yes, indeed. No nuclear, of course, that's a bad thing, so they'll be phasing out all nuclear plants in the next 10 years. May or may not include a carbon tax, may or may not include cap and trade. Certainly guaranteed job for everyone, that's fun. And of course, eliminating air travel within the next 10 years by making it so that high-speed trains make it unnecessary for planes to fly. Also, banning farting cows. So these are all fun and insane. Justin, do you think this Green New Deal should actually be called the Green Leap Forward?
Sure, if we're going to be clever and all of that. You said that in some chats we had this week, and I agree with that, obviously. I also want to know if they're just really big fans of the villains in Atlas Shrugged, so they're like doing like a cosplay thing. Doesn't this just sound like Atlas Shrugged? Like, we're going to make all these laws and draw things backwards, and then, oh, you know what? Trains! We need trains in here. It's just...
Can trains go Mach 0.85, like 600 miles an hour? Are there trains that go that fast?
That's the one part. Like, I feel like when, this is like when people, what you just did is like when people critique zombie movies, they're like, that's not realistic. That person would be shaving, wouldn't be shaving during the zombie apocalypse. That's what you just did.
Pardon me for requiring naturalism in reality.
No. My point is, there are monsters that are reanimated dead who eat humans to survive, and then when they do that, they turn other humans into humans, and you're going, you know what the problem is? Trains don't go that fast. Like, there are so many other things wrong with this that is not the thing to focus on. It's just...
What about the spelling errors throughout the document? Can we focus on that?
Yeah, that is more fundamental because it shows how stupid they are. Because that's the thing that Daniel's been pointing out about this woman from the beginning is, look, this is like the dumb girl in college who organized all the rallies. And all of a sudden now she's trying to lead the country. And everyone's like, yeah, that seems like a good idea. Yeah, she annoyed the fuck out of us in college, but let's let her lead the country. What's insane to me is, you know, Daniel, the name is very well taken, the Green Leap Forward, because it points out the irony. And it points out the flaws in the whole idea of the New Deal to begin with. They started growing government power by giving everyone something that they believed was a necessity, which is Social Security. Yeah. Then Obama did it with healthcare. And now they're saying that protecting the planet is also a necessity. And they're using this. And it's very see-through that they're using the same. It's the same imprint. They literally have not changed. It's the same imprint, and they're doing the same thing over and over again, and they're using that to just try and grab power. That's all it is, whatever the next excuse will be. Once the Green Leap Forward is complete, there'll be some other New Deal. There'll be the sexual New Deal, where they'll start telling us who we can and can't have sex with to make sure everyone gets the psychological need of sex, but then that people aren't lowering themselves and that women aren't being chained to it and women aren't being abused and women aren't being taken advantage of. That will be the next thing. There will always be another excuse they will use in the name of equality to gain power. And they will call it the New Deal, the sexual New Deal.
That's right, the sexual New Deal. Sounds like a raw deal to me. Okay.
I wish.
So, to be clear, that we're not... straw-manning this Green New Deal.
How do you do that? Forward. It's a straw man of itself.
Well, that's partially. I want to read an exact quote here, in the FAQ section. So the question is, why 100% clean and renewable, and not just 100% renewable? Are you saying we won't transition off fossil fuels? And the answer is essentially they think net zero emissions is a good thing. But this is the exact quote. We set a goal to get to net zero rather than zero emissions in 10 years because we aren't sure that we'll be able to fully get rid of farting cows and airplanes that fast. But we think we can ramp up renewable manufacturing and power production, retrofit every building in America, build the smart grid, overhaul transportation and agriculture, plant lots of trees, and restore our ecosystem to get to net zero. Mind you, that is all in 10 years. William.
Hold on. I have a lot to say about this, okay? I have two things I want to point out here.
I think we all have a lot to say about this.
Okay, so the first thing is they're going to retrofit every building in America. The government. That's what they're saying, the government?
Yes, we'll retrofit every single building in the country in 10 years.
In 10 years, okay. As everyone knows, I'm a government employee now. I work for the state highway system in California. People will call me and say, "So yeah, the signalization at the intersection of Beach and La Palma, it doesn't work and it's dangerous and it takes too long. Can you guys do something about that?" And then I talk to the people in traffic ops, and they're like, yeah, we're going to have to do a study of that. And then once we do a study, then we'll start making plans as to how to do it, and then we'll make the changes. This is for just the way the signals, the timing of the signals. It'll take like a year to change that. And
I mean,
they're going to retrofit.
The environmental impact studies alone on this proposal, can you imagine? How many EPA
literally
hours?
Literally a millennia.
Yeah.
Literally a millennia. Niqua?
Yeah, it's insane how long that would take. And then are we literally to the point like Okay, so we've talked on and on, Daniel, about environmentalism and how it's anti-man, right?
Yeah.
Now it's anti-cow? Like, are we literally to the point that we are so arrogant as a species? We are so arrogant that we're like, you know what? Cows, stop farting, cows. Stop it. You are harming the environment by eating and farting. Your mere existence, cows. Like, are we going to get in a war with India? Because we're going to have to kill all the cows, and then they're going to be like, wait, that's against our religion.
Justin, you're prescient, because we would have to get into a war with India and China because of their economic growth. They are, if we went from today, if we waved the magic wand and went to zero, even though we are 20% today, the fastest growing carbon dioxide emitters are China and India, and there's no stopping them. They're building coal plants like faster than you can even imagine.
And I'm pretty sure you just called demands. All the women in China and India cows. You take that back.
So yeah, we would have to go to war with China and India. Because if we went to zero, they would wipe out our gains within a few short years.
That's how would we bomb them? Would we take our
the Chinese
would we take
and Indians
our...
wipe out my gains?
Yes. How would we bomb China and India, William? Would we take our bullet trains across the ocean to drop our eco-bombs onto China and India? If we went to zero net carbon?
What would warfare look like without nuclear bombs?
You can't hug people with nuclear arms, Justin. Okay, just
I'm
I mean just
to think
the fact
Thanos
that
was right.
Just because this document released by a representative has the words farting cows in it doesn't mean we shouldn't take it seriously. Right, William, because this to me seems like nothing short of a radical reordering of the entirety of United States politics, culture, economy, transportation, healthcare, labor. This seems like it's calling for a total centrally planned control of basically your entire life.
Yeah, I guess we have to take it seriously in the sense that this is a real representative proposing something like this. This is definitely more radical than anything I've seen Bernie propose and get co-signed by a bunch of Democrats. They like the Green New Deal buzzword, but now that it's been put in a sort of misspelled, ungrammatical form, people are backpedaling a bit from it. I think we were joking before the show, they're backpedaling faster than the speed of light. I didn't think we would discover something faster than the speed of light, but Democrats
Wait a minute,
are running
like
from this.
They let that crazy girl do the group assignment, and then when they hand it into the professor, and the professor was like, "Are you sure that's the final draft?" They're all trying to grab it and be like, "No, that's not the final draft. Give it back."
Yeah. So what William is referring to is that although the document we just read from is an undisputed official document from Representative Ocasio-Cortez's website and her office, late on Thursday, the talking points were in fact deleted, and her chief of staff, I can't pronounce his name, so I'm not going to try, said that the document was a, quote, bad copy that was mistakenly published. Of course, after that, they tried to claim it was a Republican conspiracy theory against them, and that the same Robert Hackett, a Cornell University law professor and advisor to Cortez, told Tucker Carlson that it was doctored and that they never said anything like that. And Ocasio-Cortez herself was retweeting quote-unquote doctored versions of the Green New Deal, while ignoring the fact that the own version that she released called for the farting cows line and money to people who are unwilling to work, etc. And this is appearing to be a very Trumpian side of Representative Ocasio-Cortez, where people are pointing literally at the reality of the situation, and she's shaking her head and going, nope, didn't happen, not true, fake news. So,
you know, I know it didn't quite make the cut for this week, but I even saw a story in, I think it was Vice, which I don't trust, saying that Democrats are considering in 2020 redistricting her district out of existence. So I think that might be the Democrats' final solution, so to speak, for Ocasio-Cortez.
They're gerrymandering her out of existence?
Yep.
That's
the plan
there.
In 2020.
I mean, it's difficult for them in the sense that I suspect many of them like these proposals, but there's an Overton window problem here of what people will actually accept. Now, maybe this moves it more toward the socialist side, but right now this is far, far outside what any mainstream Democrat or Republican or leftist really is going to believe in, and it's only going to get the sort of social justice warriors up in arms here. But one point I want to make about this and get your reaction to and get maybe your heated rants to is that we've spent a lot of this time talking about how this isn't going to work, and clearly it won't work. It's an unmitigated economic disaster waiting to happen if it's enacted. But can we pause for a moment to highlight the fact that this is one of the most immoral things a representative of the United States of America has ever put in front of Congress? She is essentially saying that she has the right to control your entire life.
She has I don't know how someone who can propose this or co-sign it can take the oath of office.
It's really
I don't know how you can do that.
Just unbelievably flabbergasting in the sense of what there is no limit in this resolution to what she claims she can control about your life. She can control your labor, your businesses, your health care,
your buildings,
literal movement,
the buildings you live in and work in,
your property. She
your
is
cows.
Saying
the laws
your cows,
of physics
your
make trains go 600 miles per hour.
That's right. She's in your physics, controlling your motion. She is claiming control over your entire life. That is horrifically immoral. And we should at every stand make sure we say it, because she's the one claiming the moral high ground here. She is the one, remember, who had the insane dichotomy where she said, I may not be factually right all the time, but I am morally right. No, yep. Representative Ocasio-Cortez, you are wickedly immoral. You are immoral to the point where you should not be a representative of this country, no matter what district you're from. People, your voters, I hope will reject you. I hope recall you if possible, but I would totally support a gerrymandering of her district to get this dangerous human being out of Congress.
You know, Alex Epstein talks about on his podcast a lot, arguing to 100. What we need here in this energy sector is energy freedom, right? We don't need more government and restrictions and subsidies and meddling. We need energy freedom. There's tons of people in the world that are dying from energy poverty. And we're trying to make ourselves energy poor? It doesn't make any sense.
No, it's evil.
I mean, I agree with all that, but I'm still trying to figure out what an Ovaltine window is.
Google it, and make sure you use the word Ovaltine when you Google it.
No,
I want to know what pictures come up.
Are we surprised that it's Instagram's fault. We gave this woman, who's essentially an Instagram version of a political candidate, all this power. And what do you think someone who lives on Instagram all day is going to try to do to save the world?
Yeah, it's true. And Netflix, by the way, just bought her documentary about herself for $10 million. So, talk about not earning.
Was it entirely shot via Instagram stories?
Talk about someone who just got a lump of unearned wealth. My God. Maybe she should be forced to give that up to people who actually need it. But I don't know. This, it's part of the environmental thing, because I was so indoctrinated into it when I was younger that just really, to use a phrase, grinds my gears. It can really get my blood boiling, to keep clicheing hard. But Justin, do you have the same sort of righteous indignation reaction to this? Like, this woman is trying to claim dominion over me. That, and I would say this about any man, and I'm going to point out I said this woman, this representative is trying to claim dominion over my entire life, my child's life, my wife's life. That is abhorrent.
I mean, I get where you're coming from, but this is where I mean that the state of the midside is fully realized. Like, all I can do is laugh at this shit. Like, she's so fucking delusional that her own people want to gerrymander her out of existence, and the general population rejected this. That's how insane this is. So all I can do is laugh. Like, I think your indignation and your anger is valid. It's just like, I'm all out of anger. I'm all out of it. All I can do is just be like, oh, just go back to Instagram.
Well, before we move to the next story, I have one final question. So there's kind of two schools of thought right now about AOC. One is, hey, people on the right, don't meme about AOC. You're going to make her popular like Trump, and then we're going to have a Democrat version of Trump on our hands, and nobody wants that. Okay, so that's one school of thought. The other school of thought is the Democrats get rid of AOC because she's taking all the oxygen out of the room. Everything she does gets on the news cycle. There's no other Democrat gets anything right now, and she's stealing the spotlight from Nancy Pelosi. So what do you guys think? Which is it?
Wait, you're saying we should keep her around because she's making the other Democrats ineffective?
I'm not arguing that. I'm hearing that school of thought, right? Like, she's making them ineffective because all they talk about is her craziness. And then the other side is, don't talk about her craziness because you're going to make her popular.
Okay, I disagree completely with keeping her around because the media is too far to the left. And the more you keep her around, the more they're going to use her to make acceptable what she says through repetition. The media does that anyway with extreme things in the movies, in television, in the entertainment industry, and that's what they're going to use her for as long as she's kept around. So in that sense, I think she should be mocked to shit until the left gets rid of her, the left that actually cares about their own power gets rid of her. Because the extreme leftists who are in the media, who have their agenda of destroying people, are just going to use her to normalize things, so she's too dangerous.
So your argument is she's more Bernie than Bernie.
Yes.
Yeah, she's so Bernie that you're going to have to get that checked out by a doctor. There's a third version here, William, that is dangerous, which is why I feel like she has to be taken seriously and she has to be answered at every turn, which is she sets up an agenda that's so radical that when the Democrats propose, for instance, like just a sensible cap and trade policy, we don't need all this other nonsense that AOC is proposing. What we need is a sensible cap and trade policy that then becomes the new middle, and we just can't have that. Like it's a thing where you have to reject all of it and any of the subsequent parts that come from it. We can't say, yeah, she's crazy, anything that else is proposed is less crazy by comparison. It's all nuts. And it's all horrible, and we shouldn't allow any of it. So,
right, because what's happened with our culture, Daniel, is social media has sped up what the left has been doing. The left, for the past however many years, I mean, I'm not a historian, someone can go back and look at it, has been doing the slight creep. They propose something extreme, then do something less extreme because people are like, oh yeah, that's not so bad. Now because of social media, things are so extreme so quickly that now they can get away with even more extreme stuff because it hasn't crept as far as you're saying, the green leap forward.
Yeah. So in that sense, she should probably, I don't know if she should stay around, but everything she says should not be ignored. It should be confronted head on with, to reiterate the Alex Epstein phrase, an argument to 100. It needs to be confronted. So,
could you explain what argument to 100 means?
I just heard the phrase just now. But,
I can try. So basically, a lot of times when you get into debates with folks, when they take the moral high ground, they're arguing to their ideal, right? And if you arguing to 100, the sort of way I understand it is that you need to give them an alternative ideal, right? If human flourishing is your ideal, you should be arguing to 100 in human flourishing, not saying like, well, this cap and trade deal will hurt a lot of people, right? Because that sort of buys into their premise of, well, yeah, of course it will, but it's worth it, right? Because we're going to 100 on our side, meaning, you know, full control and no carbon emissions, right? But if you're not arguing towards energy freedom, towards the end of energy poverty, that living in a world where energy is cheap, reliable, plentiful, then you're not taking that moral high ground from them.
Yeah. Well, take the moral high ground.
Right. And that's what the left has been doing for years, making it so that it's shameful to take the opposite moral ideal from them so you don't even try to argue it. That's part of the creeping they've been doing.
Yep.
And it's because most of the opposition, quote unquote, are just another form of altruists. So their arguments are always altruism light. And it's ridiculous. Anyway, let's move on to something that's much more whimsically farcical, which I like. Whimsical. I don't know. Okay. Did you consent to being born? One man is suing his parents for giving birth to him. This is a real story from The Guardian. Raphael Samuel is a 27-year-old antinatalist from Mumbai who believes it was wrong for his mother and father to create him without his consent. Yes, so he's planning to sue them for essentially having him for their own pleasure and not for his. Okay, so he's an antinatalist. Let's get into that a tiny bit. Antinatalism is a system of belief that holds that it is morally wrong for people to procreate, and a vast amount of human misery would be avoided by simply not existing in the first place. It is a growing movement with adherents across the globe. Antinatalism has a long and quote-unquote respected pedigree, according to The Guardian. It comes in certain sects of Buddhism and Christianity, and certainly in certain sects of atheism, and more than one philosopher has argued that the optimal outcome for humanity is extinction, including Clemson University's very own Todd May. So, he says he loves his parents, and they have a great relationship, but they had, this is for quote for him, they had me for their joy and their pleasure, and he believes that it is wrong for his parents to go ahead and create him without his consent. Okay, he continues, and then this is, I'll just get your reaction to this question, Justin. This is from Samuel. Quote, isn't forcing a child into this world and then forcing it to have a career kidnapping and slavery? Justin, well, isn't it?
I mean, did this dude invent time travel? So he existed at the same time that his parents were conceiving him? It's just, as William said, this is the, you know, he wants some naturalism in his reality. That's all this is. I have to wonder if this whole thing is a stunt by this guy just to get money from his parents.
This has to be. Look at his ridiculous outfit. This has to be a troll. This has to be the biggest troll ever.
I don't think it's a troll. I think it's a stunt for attention. I mean, there's a quote in this article or another article from BBC.com about the same thing that somebody sent me. This, he says, would gradually phase out humanity from the Earth, and that would also be so much better for the planet. So I guess what you're saying, William, is this is sort of like what's the meme land called? The meme country?
Kekistan.
Yeah, this is you're arguing this is somebody from deep within 4chan in Kekistan. That's what you're saying.
I think it smells too much like it. It smells too much like it. If it's real, it's even funnier. So, like, I love those kinds of things where you can't tell if it's 4chan or reality.
All right. So I guess that's the real question here is 4chan or reality. But I could see someone hating themselves this much. And what does that say about our culture? That this is how distinguishable from this is AOC? To me, it's pretty. There's no this guy could be married to AOC as far as I can see.
Yeah, I mean, certainly his putting of wilderness or the planet above humanity and saying that the extinction of human beings would be better for the planet is a core, if not named principle of the modern environmentalist movement. It is a not well suppressed premise of the environmentalist movement. William, is there a sense to sort of play off the last article? Is there a sense in which we should take this seriously and answer it seriously, even though I am inclined to mock him ruthlessly?
I think that as the idea, just the idea of it, yes, you could take that seriously. You can say, well, how does consent work? How does volition work? What does it mean to even have volition, right? This can lead to an interesting philosophical discussion about choice, but I think that this is sort of a reducto ad absurdum, right? It just sort of like seems very obvious to me. And I could see if someone's honestly like, well, what, like, how do you answer that? I could sort of see helping someone walk through that. But no, I don't think you have to take this seriously. There is no other way. Like, he's saying that it was selfish for his parents to have him because it gave them joy. And we already know the arguments against that, right? Like, that's just pure altruism. And we already know that that's wrong. So it's just nihilism dressed up in a different philosophical baggage.
Yeah, it's I'm not sure if this exactly applies, but it reminds me of Ayn Rand's fallacy of the stolen concept, where you have to use the concept you're attacking in order to attack that concept. So I'm mad at my parents for not giving me choice, or sorry, not giving me a choice, but the only way I have choice is if my parents create me and give me choice.
Yeah, exactly.
Like volitional, volition.
Exactly.
So it's difficult. Justin, this reminds me of a cartoon from a long time ago from Saturday Morning Breakfast Cereal, where this guy gets up to heaven and he's talking to God and he says, God, why is something better than nothing? And God responds by saying, I don't know. Gee, let me call up the nothing verse and ask how they're doing. It's kind of how I feel about this.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's the ultimate argument that convinced me to be an atheist, right? Where the biggest argument for God is that there has to be some sort of first mover, first creator. But that presupposes the idea that there was nothing before there was something, which is just, that's an anti-concept, isn't it?
Yeah, nothing only makes sense when you have something to compare it against.
Yeah. Exactly.
And when that's the ultimate thing is to why you have to wonder if this is a troll or not, and if this is just someone who deeply hates himself, because it's like, so yeah, you're complaining that, like, yeah, you have to get a career and everything, which, yeah, that's tough. Like, no one's arguing like it's easy to be alive, but what's the alternative? You're really arguing you would rather not exist?
It seems now, like something that you could fix easily yourself if you'd rather not exist.
It's true. If you're so angry that your parents didn't give you consent, there's a way to fix it. Anyway, that got morbid. Okay, a district named Dixie. This is my favorite story of the year so far. Marin County Schools' name sparks controversy over racism. In Northern California, far from the battlefields of the Civil War, a fight over a school district's name is pitting neighbor against neighbor. San Rafael, a community of 59,000 just north of, guess where, San Francisco, is as proud of its progressive politics as it is of the city's alluring views of the bay. But the city's majority-white Dixie School District has come under scrutiny as activists push to change the name, noting its link to the Confederacy and slavery. Noah Griffin, a longtime Marin County resident who is among a group advocating for the name change, says the word Dixie sends a racially charged message to area families, especially minorities, of sentimentality for a time when white supremacy flourished in the Old South. Quote, we somehow, in our privileged bubble, think we don't have to move into the 21st century. We say that's not so. The Confederacy doesn't need an outpost in Marin County. And this is where we meet the farce, ladies and gentlemen. The push has met some resistance, though. Some say the issue is being perpetuated by a few vocal people interested in political correctness rather than preserving local history. Members of the We Are Dixie group, who couldn't even give their names because they've been faced harassment and threats from people online, said the district's identity has literally nothing to do with the pro-slavery South. It was, in fact, named for Mary Dixie, a Native American woman affiliated with James Miller, the school district's founder. Justin, when will the language policing stop? When will it stop? When will it stop? Can we just move on with our lives?
I don't want to move on with my lives. From this article, I was convinced to stop using Dixie cups. It's never going to stop, Daniel. It's never going to stop until they get exactly what they want. And of course, they're never going to get what they want, because what they're actually looking is to cure some psychological ailment that they have, which is they need validation because they hate themselves. So it's never going to stop. It is never going to stop.
It likely will never stop. William, should it's named after a Native American woman whose last name happened to be Dixie. Could you argue that it's racist for this group to want to change the name?
Yeah, I think this is erasing Native American history, right? Like this is you can see apparently in the oppression Olympics, apparently Native American is not as high up as black, which is going to be news to some. I also think
where
it's funny.
Where is Elizabeth Warren?
I don't know. She's disavowed
her
Native American
her
heritage. Yeah. I think it's also interesting in the article, Daniel, you haven't mentioned yet, the people who want, who are supporting, pointing out that, that this is a Native American person that the school's district's named after, and they've started a group to keep the name Dixie, they've had to keep themselves anonymous for fear of reprisals.
Yes, which is a telling sign of our times, that you can't even hold a totally rational position on an issue without being attacked by what people they call social justice thugs. And I think that is totally right. They are social justice thugs who are one step away from punching Nazis, i.e. anyone who disagrees with them.
I think that so, when the school district votes on the proposed name changes, I believe they should change their name from Dixie to Antifa and just get it over with.
There you go.
So that the Antifa school district. Yep.
That sounds good to me. Of course, this is California, right, Justin? Could it happen anywhere else? Of course, this is California.
Well, no, I only found this because I have to look at the daily news clips, or I have to find daily news clips at work because apparently I'm the personal Twitter feed for the executive staff at Caltrans D12. And because of that, I go through the LA Times and the OC Register and the San Diego Union Tribune. And every day I find several articles that are very farcical. And this was just a prime example of how crazy California is to me. And what it really reveals is what you guys said about the whole that she's not actually from the South. She's Native American. That's where the name comes from. It's how all of this is catchphrases. Might upset the audience a little bit, but I complained about this within the objectivist community, catchphrase objectivism, where people haven't read what Rand read, or they haven't even read all of Rand, and they just repeat her conclusions as if they truly understand what she was saying. Well, it's the same thing here on the left as well. Again, I'm going to rail on Instagram. This is Instagram culture. It's something that looks good on a post. It looks good in a story. To say, oh, yeah, we want to start farting cows. Oh, we want to make trains go faster than airplanes. All of that sounds good on an Instagram post because you don't think about it. It's just surface level. And you go, oh, yeah, that person, they're pretty good. They go, oh, we want to make the name Dixie go away because that has to do with the Confederacy and we're against racism. If you don't think about it, you go, yeah, racism is bad. So let's get rid of the Confederacy and our Confederate roots. On a surface level, we can all agree that that sounds good on a surface level if you're disconnected from reality. And that's what this is. And that's what California is.
Yes, indeed. I was going to say, oh, perhaps if they were going to really troll these social justice thugs, they should add a General James T. Hooker entrance to the Dixie school building. So, to call back to an earlier story. Well, now it's time to get to the last story, which is going to be difficult for me because I can't say most of these words that are in it. But CNN asked the question, because hashtag reputable news organization, wonder why men send photos of their genitals? Here are some theories. Okay. Yes, we're going to really do this, people. Okay, here we go.
How is this not farce? How is this not farce that CNN has published this article and that dick pics are such a big deal in our culture that this is what we discuss in our culture?
Okay. This is how the article starts. She's sitting in a crowded subway car, zipping through email messages on her phone and minding her own business when it appears a photo of a man's penis.
Dun,
sexting
dun, dun.
Is so...
It sounds like it just appears above her head.
I thought he walked onto the train. That's what I picture. Like the doors opened and a picture of a penis walked onto the car. grabbed the handrail. Sexting is so commonplace that 88% of participants, men and women, in a 2015 study said they'd done it. Not just received it, but actually participated in sexting. So common that research psychologist Peggy Drexler wonders if there's even any stigma attached to it anymore. So common that, as we found out last week, even someone as high profile as Amazon founder Jeff Bezos said that an outlet threatened to release compromising photos of him. If it's done in a consensual relationship, like other sexual behaviors, it isn't necessarily harmful. But men will often send such photos unsolicited to women. Here are theories why. So then it goes through a list of theories, which I'll just list off without reading a lot of explanation to them. This is theory number one. Men often misperceive a woman's interest. Yes, men aren't good at gauging a woman's level of interest, so they send them a picture of their junk. Theory number two, men are attached to their private parts.
Literally. So,
psychotherapist Jeanette Stern said that men, you know, really like their genitalia, and so they want other people to like them too. Theory number three, men may get a thrill out of it. So far, these are all riveting. Theory number four, in some cases, it's born of hostility. Yes, men want to weaponize the junk.
I will threaten you with a picture of my penis.
And of course, we couldn't get through any social justice article without the fifth theory here, which is it may be out of dominance. Men want to dominate women with photos of their penises. For many people, it's an impulse thing. That's number six. And then number seven, there's some evolutionary basis to it. Sex educator and researcher Justin Lay Miller agrees with the sentiment that it's sexual signaling that's designed to stimulate conditions from which reproductive sexual behavior can happen. So you are evolved, Justin, to snap those pics and click send to 100 women. Justin, do any of these theories resonate with you for why you send dick pics?
Now there's someone standing behind me as I'm about to talk about this. Super awkward. So all I heard from this article when you were listing off the theories was that there is a biological reason for catcalling. That's what you just told me.
Okay. All right.
Wait, so are you also telling me that if I had just, when I was younger, whipped my dick out, that there'd be a higher percentage chance of me having sex? Is that what you're saying? That was the secret all these years?
Just scream, evolution, wha-bam!
It sounds like the cognate to Spring Break from Arrested Development.
Spring Break, woo! Yeah.
No, I mean, look, isn't the reason that dudes send dick pics is they want someone to look at their dick? Isn't that it? Like, why are we overcomplicating this?
They want someone to admire it, right? I mean, that's what it's about.
I guess. I mean...
Sure. I mean, that would include that with the looking at. Like, you don't, like, show someone a movie you made because you want them to just look at it. You also want to say it's good.
That's right. Here it is. Please tell me it's good.
Yeah, that's pretty much what it is. I agree. Okay.
Yeah, I don't... I feel like we're delving a little too deep into this. I feel like this is not... I don't know. At this point, it just seems like it's a weird self-perpetuating meme to actually use meme in the sense that, like, Richard Dawkins meant it. Like, it just seems like it's a thing that guys do because it's a thing that guys do. And that's insane, but, you know, there's lots of that, I assume. If 88% of people have engaged in sexting, then it's apparently crossed some cultural threshold where there's some norm to it.
Daniel, are they saying 88% of people have sent naked pictures, or are they saying 88% of people have sent, like, provocative text messages? Because I think there's a difference. To me, I thought sexting was like, oh, wow, like, with your significant other, you, like, are like, I want to do you later. And obviously, don't send that because it's not very hot.
But super romantic.
Yeah, super romantic, right? You get the point I'm making. I thought that was sexting, but are we defining sexting now as sending
sex
naked pictures?
Later.
Yeah, I think they are. I think you have a good point there, Justin. I think they're conflating things right there at the get-go of the article, because they talk about being in a relationship, 80-whatever% in a relationship have sexted or whatever. But then they switch to this different thing of guys sending, quote-unquote, unsolicited dick pics, right? Like, it is a weird thing to talk about. I don't think 85% of guys are sending unsolicited dick pics.
Yeah, they're certainly confusing people here, and so that's nothing new for CNN, but it should be called out when they do it.
And this isn't unique to heterosexual relationships. If I open up any gay dating app, I get bombarded with penis pics. So, I'm not even that good of a looking dude.
On a gay dating app, I think it'd be worse on a gay dating app.
Exactly.
That doesn't sound like the gays I know. So it is like if 88% of participants have participated in sexting, and you're going to ask an article, what is the reason that men are sending pictures of their junk? Doesn't one of the answers have to be like that something their partner wants them to engage in? at some point, that has to be one of the major theories and probably the overwhelming theory of why most get sent, I would suspect. If 88% of people are participating. So I don't know. This just feels like CNN has some agenda that is anti-man or, you know, I don't know.
Well, look, CNN let's is be terrible. Fair for That's, a second here.
Let's all agree.
It's anti-dick.
That CNN is terrible. Can look, we disagree on that? Can that unite the nation, please?
Sure, I can unite the nation, and I agree with what you said. I agree with everything about what you said. But I want to put forward two other things, and there is a legitimate question that's born out of this. But
just,
it's not
you just
the
want
same...
to put forward just two other things?
Okay, three. Two balls and a dick, okay?
There you go.
Yeah. Well, how do you know I have two balls?
Statistics? I don't...
Maybe I had cancer when I was a kid, huh? Well, that's
Could
insensitive. Don't assume how many balls I have. Don't assume my ball gender. I don't know what I'm saying right now. No, so I agree with what you're saying about the relationship thing and everything. And I'm going to lead to a question, which isn't the question you think I'm going to lead to. So I do think that there are guys who on dating apps, and I'm sure this is what William is talking about, are using it as sort of like a let's cut to the chase here. Right? I'm going to send you my dick and I'm going to see how you respond to it.
Yep.
I don't think it's malicious. I just think it's like, I don't want to waste my fucking time. So when I send you my dick, if you say I like it, then that dick's going to go places I want it to go. I think there is that.
Oh, where your dick will go.
Yes.
That's a long lost Dr. Seuss book.
I mean, it makes me think of the hormone monster on... Big Mouth. Right, where the one who we think is Will Arnett, but it's not actually Will Arnett, he always pulls out those fuzzy dicks and just hands them to people. Like, that's what a dick pic is to me. He's just like, here's my fuzzy dick. And then, like, people play with the dick or they don't. Like, but then also, I think there may
be... Is it fuzzy or low resolution?
the hormone monster's dick is fuzzy.
Oh, okay.
I do think there are also men who send it to be aggressive. Now, what percentage that is... I do think it's kind of like a giant middle finger, right? Like, what is a bitter middle finger? An actual middle finger?
Kind of
dick?
Like that, yeah.
Yeah. So
Depends
I do think
the
there are. But here's the question. It's the same thing with the catcalling question. There is the meme of women saying they get a lot of dick pics. But how many women actually... This is the question. How many women actually receive dick pics? And how many are just saying they are to A, seem... and feel more attractive than they are, and B, feel like they're part of the in-group of like, oh yeah, I'm one of those women who receive dick pics, and to be cool and be part of the culture. So that's why my question about how frequent and how often this actually occurs.
Not to know and you, but I'm not sure there's a huge group of women where getting more dick pics puts you in the in-group, but maybe. I'm just thinking of speaking to some of our midsiders out there who might disagree with that, but maybe it is to some percent. I'm not sure.
And then how many guys would it take on a dating app to send their dick pic? Like, if you're sending a dick pic out as like your opening line or within the first couple messages, you know, they do that for everyone, right? Like, it doesn't take a very large population of people sending dick pics to make it very common for some women to receive dick pics. Does that make sense?
That's true. Like, we should ask that owl who does the Tootsie Pop commercial. How many men does it take?
Okay. I was going to say, how many dick pics does it take to get to the center?
And also, how do you know it's their dick? They could be sending you some random dick they found on the internet.
I literally had never conceived of that notion until now.
In the era of catfishing, you didn't think somebody went to Google and went dicks to send as dick pictures on Tinder.
Is there like a business? It's like a website where you can buy like ones that match your skin tone and your general height. It's, you know, sizable but not oversizable for your body. That sounds like a good business for you, Justin.
Dick model?
Are you saying
dick
there's
model?
A correlation? You are falling into the myth that there's a correlation between height and dick size?
I'm just saying. I did not know there was... I assumed, but I didn't know there was a general myth about it.
All right, I think that's enough.
Triggered. Sorry earlier for cis testicling you.
All right, that's enough. That's enough. While we're talking about awkward sexual things, I think it's time to head into the hopeful romantic with JML. Put me into syndication, broadcast to if you enjoy the movie analysis, the film analysis, the TV analysis, narrative analysis that I do on this show, then you are going to enjoy the live stream I do next Saturday. And if Daniel, you could do the math on what the date is next Saturday real quick, because I'm terrible with numbers. Next Saturday at noon Pacific time with Midsider Katrina, you're going to enjoy that live stream, because it is all about the films of M. Night Shyamalan and why the media and why the general culture is against him, especially in light of his most recent movie, Glass. So again, that's next Saturday, the what day?
16th.
Saturday the 16th on Midsider Katrina's YouTube channel. It's going to be an M. Night Shyamalan-a-thon. No, not a thon, but analysis, a live stream about his films. And I'll be sending out the link to the Patreon subscribers here, to our Twitter and Facebook platforms as well. And I'll share it in Discord as well. So it's another reason to join Discord. So we were just talking about dick pics, Daniel and William. Do you want to join the Pen 15 Club?
No, thanks.
This sounds like something high schoolers would do, but what the hell is Pen 15?
You don't remember this from when you were a kid? Did you never have this, William? Did you have this in your school?
No, but I know what it is.
So when I was young, and we were in like elementary school, actually, I don't even know if it was middle school, people would say, you want to join the Pen 15 Club? And you were like, oh, what's that? And they were like, oh, you join the club and you get 15 free pens a month. And you're like, oh, okay, that sounds pretty good. But we have to write Pen 15 on your hand or your arm. And then they write Pen 15 on your hand or arm, and what does it look like?
Oh.
It's a dick pic. Like...
Right, so this is their way of tricking you into writing penis on your arm. It's the same thing, Daniel. Have you heard this one? How do you spell HIV, Daniel?
H-I-V.
Are you positive?
Yes.
These are the things hilarious kids do. Well, then Hulu decided it would be a good idea to name a television show Pen 15. And this show is two adult women playing the 13-year-old versions of themselves at middle school. So it's them going to school at 17 years old. And one of them is 31 years old. So this is a 31-year-old playing herself as 13 on a TV show. Now, to make this even worse, the other kids in the show are played by kids. So the first question I have to ask both of you before I even go into how terrible the show is, if this was men starring in this show, wouldn't this be considered being sexual predators and having a TV show about being a sexual predator?
All I could think was, how creepy is that? It's ridiculous.
It's really creepy. And that's the thing. Even in the scenes where it's just them playing themselves and they're just talking to each other, it's like, why am I watching adult women pretend to be 13 years old? It's very bizarre. And then, of course, it goes down the naturalistic route. So in episode 3, one of them discovers masturbation.
Oh, no.
Yes.
Oh, no.
It's exactly what you think. You're sitting here and you're watching this show and if you're turning your brain off, right, like I just said with these catchphrases and everything, this Instagram life, you're just like, oh, yeah, this is a joke about a 13-year-old discovering masturbation. But then I take a step back and I go, this is literally just watching a 31-year-old woman masturbate. That's all this is.
Oh, no. Justin, where do you find
these
shows?
How did you stand watching this? Yeah.
Okay, first of all, I stopped halfway through the first episode. I was like, I can't do this. This is too much.
I stopped halfway through the 36th time I watched it.
No. I stopped halfway through the first episode. For the first half of the first episode, I'm like, this is like a train wreck. I can't watch it. Look away. I don't understand what's going on right now.
Look away.
Why does this exist? And then I was like, I wonder how they do the makeup for the braces. Like, those are staying on there. Like, what do they use? Like, that spirit gum must be really good.
Spirit gum.
And then I stopped watching. And then I wake up this morning and walk out, and it's on the television. It's just playing right before the show. And then I'm just like, why does this even exist? I mean, this is, look, remember how we made fun of Orange is the New Black for showing her, like, go to the bathroom?
That's as far as I got into the show, literally.
Yep. Right, 100%. This is the same thing. It's just applied to comedy now. How is this funny at all? How is this passing as a show? Why do we make this?
You said this is on Hulu?
Yes, this is a Hulu original.
Ugh. Hulu.
That's your answer to the question? Hulu?
I can't imagine with all the great comedians out there, all the great comedy writers out there, when we have shows like, you know, Last Man Standing and things like that, why this? How does this this can't have an audience? Who can stand watching this?
Handmaid's Tale, is there any reason to watch Hulu original programming?
No, it's all social justice programming.
I mean, the only stuff I watch on Hulu at this point is, like, the Titan Games, because I don't watch stuff when it's live.
Yeah. And that's The Rock, damn it.
Right. I'm trying to find...
President-elect The Rock.
I mean, like, The New Yorker wrote the giddy surreality and emotional honesty of Pen 15, and then Washington Post, Hollywood is finally portraying middle school as the awkward, miserable, probably experience that it is.
No, Netflix Hollywood's never done that.
And Pen 15 are changing the way TV does teen sex.
By making it pedophile TV or
teen sex?
Vox,
Rob.
Hulu's Pen 15 review, a hilarious love letter to your middle school best friend.
Ugh. Gross. People, stop watching this garbage. Not that our listeners are watching this garbage, but
remember,
tell your
Boy
loser
Meets World
friends
came out?
To stop watching this garbage.
I do. I remember that.
Boy Meets World is the show about middle school that you need to watch.
That's right. Because you can romanticize middle school without making it all, you know, lollipops and sunshine and roses and rainbows. And that's what I think that show did, is it romanticized middle school, but it still allowed them to confront actual problems and issues that middle schoolers were having. Or that adults could still associate with.
To think, I was afraid of Bo Burnham's Eighth Grade. Now I wonder what was in that movie, if this is what was in this movie. Or this show. It's just...
I'm assuming you don't recommend this.
That sounds like a resounding thumbs up. What are you talking about?
Yeah. I mean, if you want to see how bad our culture is... Look, this is... Look, if you want to watch a show about teenage that's funny and, like, puberty that's funny, go watch Big Mouth on Netflix. Besides the Planned Parenthood episode, every other episode of that show has been great. All right, let's move forward to Trailer Takedown. As always, the trailers for the upcoming episode are posted on the website, themidside.com/podcast, either on Friday or Saturday. You can watch those trailers before the episode. You can watch it after the episode. You can watch it during the episode. Maybe even alternate. Watch it, listen, or watch a trailer, listen to what we say about it. Watch a trailer, listen to what we say about it.
Trailer Takedown. First trailer.
The White Crow was a very bipolar trailer for me. So this was submitted by Midsider JP in Discord. And I'm watching the first half of this, and it's like, if you don't dance, you don't live. And they go to France, and there's subtitles. And the cinematography is very, like, muted and very depressed. And I'm like, this is terrible. I don't want to watch this. And then all of a sudden it's like, but he's from the Soviet Union and they're trying to stop him from being free. And then the second half of the trailer is like a completely different movie. It's like this guy trying to fight for his freedom, and he does it because he's a dancer and that allows him to, like, defect from the Soviet Union. And I'm like, wait, this looks somewhat interesting. This looks really interesting. It really reminds me of Whiplash. But here's the thing about a movie like this, and this Trailer Takedown is probably going to be one where a lot of people doubt me because of my picks here. But I can't get past the stylization of this movie. It feels like if I sat down to watch this movie, I would probably fall asleep because it looks like it's so slow and plodding. And the cinematography does everything, as I said, it seems very muted. It does everything to take the life out of this. So this is a movie about someone fighting for life and freedom, and it doesn't seem to be a very celebratory movie. So simply because of the aesthetics, I have to tackle this.
Tackle.
Dan?
Well, you have literally never been more wrong in your life. Everyone agrees. People tell me you've never been more wrong. Justin, this is Whiplash meets The Lives of Others. Did you ever see that movie about East Berlin?
Sounds terrible.
It's one of the best movies ever made. But other than that, it's terrible. No. This movie's going to be awesome. Did you get past it? Wasn't it you who, not last week because I wasn't here, but the week before, talked about how, like, oh, M. Night doesn't make the best looking movies, but you got to look at the plot and the characters and whatever. Okay, so the cinematography isn't perfect. But what was one of the key lines in this trailer? Every life must have a purpose. And then he talks about when she, like, what do you want more than anything? I want to be free. This is a celebration of freedom and purpose in one's life. This seems like it's going to be killer. And anything that takes down the Soviet Union, I'm good with. And I'm hugging the shite out of this movie.
And when you see it and tell me it's good, I will like it. I will watch it. I'm just afraid that I would get bored because of the way it's shot. Because it's shot by Voldemort, I believe. And I don't know how good of a director he could be. But the main character had a really badass line too, I believe. And I can't remember what it was in the first
half
of the
trailer. There were several of them. They were very good. Maybe that's the whole movie.
I'll probably end up seeing it. Everyone who listens to the show is going to be like, oh, you need to do an episode on this movie. And then I'm going to do it, and I'm going to love it, and I'm going to look stupid, okay? But I'm just telling you, I was very off-put by the stylization. That's all I'm saying.
Fine. William?
Well, this has some worrying elements, it seems, but it seemed like a good movie to me. I when I watched the trailer, I was kind of like Justin in the beginning of the trailer. I was like, oh, this is going to be a social justice movie of some kind, but it actually
seemed very pretentious.
Yeah. Very pretentious, very, high handed, but those lines that he said, I almost don't believe that those lines that they say in the trailer are in the movie. You know, like, it's like that's not how a Hollywood movie is made. So
this is called the Snyder Cut effect.
Yeah. Yeah. So for now, I have to give it a questionable hug.
Hug?
Oh, we're breaking out the different hugs and tackles today because William is doing the drops.
I'm trying to.
This is where you do the second one, William.
Second trailer.
The sun is also a star is also a tackle. this is like the exact opposite. Like the cinematography of this movie was very like crisp. And I was like, I enjoyed looking at this trailer. I'm not put off by this trailer. I very much enjoyed looking at it. And, you know, they weren't annoying. It was just sort of like a generic rom-com. And then I was like, of course, they're going to do a black woman and an Asian guy and social justice and blah, blah, blah. And then it got like 3/4 of the way through the trailer and they were like in love. And she's like, but I have to leave tomorrow. And he's like, why? She's like, I'm not from here. My country's leaving. My family's going back to my country tomorrow. And I was like, I'm out. I don't want to deal with this crap about how, like, the dreamers and the young lovers need to stay in this country illegally. Tackle? I was not angry. I also am not constipated.
It's fun hearing the sound effects for once, since I never listened to the show. I didn't have as negative a reaction to this because it did start off very social justice-y and then it went kind of to a love story, but I have to suspect that the love story is only to sell the social justice, so that leads me back to my general skepticism. I don't know, looked interesting. Looked about as interesting as this kind of movie could be, but nonetheless, I'm never going to watch it. Tackle!
Yeah, this looks like Oscar bait. Of some kind, right? This is for all those dreamers out there, that huge audience of Americans that are being deported. This is to tell their story. I don't think I'm going to like this movie.
Tackle.
Oscar bait sounds like a very particular fetish.
I was thinking it meant someone named Oscar masturbating.
Too literal.
Final trailer.
Wow, he even used the final trailer. I was worried you were going to make a mistake and you were going to do third trailer, but good work. Good job.
Thank you.
Shaft is the reboot, sequel. I don't know. I haven't seen the original of any of these movies, but it stars Samuel L. Jackson, Richard Roundtree, some young guy I've never heard of as Shaft Jr. And in it, there's a caper involving Shaft and Shaft Jr.
This and is Shaft where you're
all... Shaft Senior? Yeah. Yeah, well, there's three of them, right? I'm assuming, isn't Richard Roundtree the original Shaft?
I don't know.
Is it he? Wasn't there a movie starring Samuel Jackson as Shaft? I don't know. Look, I don't know. I don't care about any of that. I know, Daniel, you're going to get mad that it's like a reboot and a remake.
That's racist.
But...
I just heard Justin doesn't care about black people. Just no, like President Bush.
Wait, let me, can I finish? Can I finish? I just imagined actually Dana Carvey saying that during sex and it got really creepy. Anyway, this is where you all are going to start to doubt me and my choices here. Because when it got to the scene where Shaft Jr. Was like, you can't hit a woman. That's misogynistic. And they start arguing about misogyny. And then Samuel Jackson as Shaft goes, you're the one being misogynistic. I didn't even mention gender. I was like, I'm in. I think this looks fun. This looks fun, okay? I think I would have a really fun time with this movie. It didn't go into stereotypes. It was just like, here's a badass black guy. Here's this annoying, whiny kid. And I know they already tried to do this with Die Hard 5, and it failed miserably. But I think Samuel Jackson can carry this. I'm in. Hug.
Hug.
You're not totally insane. I started to roll my eyes at the beginning of this trailer, but it got better. And there were some lines where I snickered, so that's a good sign. This reminds me of a Kingsman-esque action movie that sort of knows it's going to be over the top and embraces the over the topness and just goes for it. So it could be good. I think my wife is going to see this movie because she sees every action movie that's ever been put into a theater. So there's some chance I'll watch this and I will tentatively hug it.
Hug.
Vindicated.
I too thought that this trailer started off a little weak, but it actually got a couple giggles from me, which is a high bar for comedy. And I think that there's interesting chemistry between the three actors that'll be fun to watch. So I am in.
Hug.
I feel so good. I thought you guys were all going to rip me apart for tackling the first one and hugging the last one, but I feel a lot better now.
I look forward to mocking you relentlessly when the first one ends up being the best movie of the year.
Impossible. It has subtitles.
This is a movie I ain't here to read.
All right. You know what I am here to talk about, though? The Super Bowl champion New England Patriots. Let's
go, Pats!
A Super Bowl edition of Belichick Your Premises.
Don't talk to the geniuses that are online.
What was the condition to rule and control? The media sells it, and you live the role. Mental wounds still screaming, driving me insane. I'm going off the rails on a crazy train. I'm going off the rails on a crazy train.
Recorded a week after the Patriots won their sixth Super Bowl in 10 appearances, 9 with Brady and Belichick. There's That's Walker's right. Get it right. Actually, 11. Why did you press spoilers?
Because it's spoilers, man.
It's actually for 11 those Super Bowl appearances.
DVR'd the Super Bowl and haven't gotten to it yet. And who also have never gone outside.
You give me a new toy, I'm going to utilize it.
It also understands a reference from season 2 of The Walking Dead meets spoilers when we haven't used it in 4 seasons on here.
Oh, God.
Okay, well, as William just pointed out, the Patriots won by a score of 13-3. And almost immediately, I think during the game, you already heard people trying to undermine the Super Bowl. And they were undermining it by calling the game boring. So the question I have to ask is this just another way to undermine a Patriots Super Bowl title? Well, yeah, they won 6, but man, that 6 victory was boring. Or is this a symptom of our culture's obsession with offense? And here's the more fundamental question. Was the Super Bowl actually boring if you weren't a Patriots or Rams fan?
Well, I'm a Patriots fan, so it's hard to put myself outside that context. But I think this is just a symptom of our burnt out pleasure centers, because there were things happening all the time. There are good plays being made almost every single play, whether it was by the offense or the defense. In this game, it just happened to be mostly the defense on both sides that made good plays. The Patriots got a lot of pressure. It was very interesting. Aaron Donald was always fun to watch on the Rams, even if he wasn't as effective as he's normally been. And then, of course, they're sort of figuring out game planning and watching it all unfold. That's all interesting. So for those of you who are bored by the Super Bowl, I hate to be a hipster here, but it sounds like you just don't like football. Because football is more than scoring touchdowns. In fact, you could argue, and I think successfully so, that the vast majority of football is something other than scoring touchdowns. So
yeah, I'm with
just
you. I'm
in
with
it
you, Daniel.
To like, see points,
I stopped watching basketball probably about like 8 or 9 years ago. Stopped watching the NBA. Why? There is no defense. There's nothing. The game is just scoring points back and forth with no sort of plays or, you know, really anything going on, right? This game, this Super Bowl was the opposite of that. It was all the chess moves between the defensive line, the offensive line, and the plays and the changing of the formations. It was all the stuff, if you understand football, that made it a nail biter, and you were glued to the screen every play because you were wondering, could this defense outplay the Rams offense or the other way around? It was incredibly exciting to me as someone who's watched football since I was like 4 years old.
Yeah. Let me place my criticism in a more positive way than what I did. Not be so goddamn condescending. If you were bored by this game, then I would suggest that it would behoove you to go learn a little bit more about play calling and formations and offensive line versus defensive line, so that you won't be bored in the future. And I think if you really do love football, that will make your football watching experience more joyous overall, even for games that are high scoring. So it's a thing where, okay, maybe you were bored, but I don't think that means the game was boring. It means you were bored by the game, but often when one is bored by something, it means they don't generally understand it.
Justin, how much of this boring meme is the fault of the broadcasters? Because I think in the NFC and AFC championship games, we had some fairly good broadcasting, right? Like breaking down of plays and really showing what's going on and getting those more casual fans into it. I didn't see a lot of that in the second half of the Super Bowl. They made a point that it was a low-scoring game, but they weren't really showing why or how it was such a low-scoring game.
Well, this is what you're pointing out is an issue that's been around for a very long time. I mean, as I've ranted on numerous times in this episode already, it's now resulted in the Instagram culture, the catchphrase culture, where football analysis has become a joke to the point that people make fun of, you know, the John Maddenisms, where it's like, well, you're going to have to score more touchdowns to win the game. Like, that's the level of analysis. It's to the point now that Tony Romo does good analysis, and he does it every once in a while, and everyone thinks he's like the genius of geniuses ever out there. Now imagine if you actually had Tom Brady or Bill Belichick or even Peyton Manning in the booth analyzing what's going on. Well, it would be another level.
To your point, Justin, ESPN, as much as I hate them, has capitalized on this and has a ESPN Plus exclusive show where Peyton Manning does break down these games, and it's going crazy well because people actually want that. They're yearning for it.
Yeah, I saw a clip of that where he was talking about like Brady and Goff, I think, or might have been Brady and Breeze. And he was talking about like what makes them so good and showed highlights of them. And then he immediately cut back to highlights of himself. And I was like, I can't watch this.
That's not the one I watch, but that is so Peyton Manning. It's hysterical. Now, the one I watched was from the AFC Championship game where he broke down one of the offensive plays. And it was really interesting. He didn't go back to shots of himself. But
But this is what they should be doing live. They should be doing live where, like, you look at the formation, you're like, three wide on the left, two wide on the right. Oh, now he's in motion. And Romo does a little bit of that. And, like, you can see, like, oh, he's pointing at his head, so he's changing the play. And Romo does some of that. But this is what we should have. Because now in this culture, and it's not just in sports, but in this culture, everyone wants the high score. Because, Daniel, as you said with the pleasure centers, it's all about just that endorphin rush. Oh, they want the endorphin rush of the touchdown. But that's not really the game. And honestly, for me, a high-scoring shootout is less tense than this Super Bowl was. Because in this Super Bowl, one play would have changed everything. And it did, right? The one interception changed it. One play changes the one interception in the fourth quarter. One play changes everything. One big mistake changes everything. So there's so much more tension. Whereas in a shootout, it's just like you're looking at the clock and you're like, are we scoring quick enough? Are we scoring quick enough?
Yeah, so Justin, you made a great point. This game was so tense because there were so few mistakes on the defensive side, right? It's hard to call a dropped pass a mistake on the offensive side because they happen sometimes. But you saw such good pressure being applied by the Patriots. The pass rush, like everything, right? Like they were taking chances and they were succeeding. Any one of those someone could have turned the wrong way or blocked the wrong person, and that would have been a huge play and would have turned the tide of the game.
Right. And the one big mistake, and it didn't like cause a problem, but it would have changed the game tremendously, is Dante Hightower dropped that interception at the beginning of the third quarter. He made the great play and then dropped it. Like, that was a mistake. But Daniel, if you want to make a comparison to this game and how close it is and how one insane thing can change it, to me, this was the first Giants Super Bowl, 18-1, but the Giants didn't have the helmet catch. That's the only difference in this game and that Super Bowl to me. Super low scoring. Both defenses played tremendously well. There was even a dropped interception in that game by Asante Samuel, except in that game, Eli got away from the pressure on that one play and the helmet catch was made. So they were able to win the game because what was the score? That was 17-14, whereas this one was 13-3. To me, that's the difference. It's the same exact type of game. Everyone heralds that game because the Patriots lost, but it's the exact same game.
Yeah, imagine if Gilmore didn't make that interception, Cooks had caught it there on the 1 yard line or something.
Or Jason like McCourty hadn't run in and hit that ball away at the last second where Cooks was wide open in the end zone.
Yeah, exactly. I think this is a cultural issue as much as it is anything else. For instance, is the movie Alien boring? And I ask that because if you put the Super Bowl in the same year the movie Alien comes out, I think people don't see this as a boring Super Bowl. They see it as not the best Super Bowl ever to that point or something like that, but just as good as any other Super Bowl. And the reason I made the comparison is that people forget that the movie Alien, which is heralded as a masterpiece, and it is a masterpiece, you don't see the alien for over an hour. Over an hour into the movie. Imagine if that was kind of a movie released today.
You couldn't do it. You have to show the movie in the first... you have to show the alien in the first frame, right?
You have to show the alien in the trailer.
Yeah.
Right, you have to show it in the trailer, you have to show it in the first 6 minutes, you have to show it in the next 7 minutes, you have to show it in the next 8 minutes, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Otherwise, you know, the pleasure centers in our brains don't get the endorphins we need to tweet about it. So we've lost the ability to, wait for the good things, to have some suspense. And what I mean is there were good offensive plays in this game, if that's what you prefer, but they were fewer and far between the great defensive plays. So it's not as flashy, it's not as big, but it doesn't mean it was boring.
And Daniel, I'm going to pull this all the way back to the news to make your point. Is more gratifying? Is it more gratifying to just like immediately send a dick pic so she sees your dick and she's like, okay, that's his dick? Or is it more gratifying to wait and wait and build anticipation and then she finally sees it and then you have sex? Which is more gratifying?
I think I'm supposed to choose the latter.
Yes. Well, that's my point. Just with sex in general, isn't it better to build anticipation than just to be like, okay, let's have sex now? Like, isn't that the value of foreplay?
That's why so many people are burned out on the sexual culture, because it's just easy sex, right? That's everything goes back to that. You might just call it delayed gratification in general. And we as a culture have basically eschewed that in its entirety and said, no, thank you, that's not for us. When it's for you, it's how your brain actually works.
Well, so. It's how your brain actually works. And to bring this back to football and to bring this back to what Bill Belichick did this season, you have to earn things in life. That's why your brain works to have delayed gratification be more enjoyable, because that's what life is. You have to work and you have to earn things. This flashy, all offense, no defense football is an attempt not to earn it. And what I mean by that is you think that if you just score a lot of points, you are going to win just by purely making it impossible for the other person to overcome the amount of points you've scored. But statistically, Daniel, did you know the top 11 offenses in playoff history have never won the Super Bowl?
Hmm. I did not know that.
Defense,
I mean, I know
wins championships. And Bill Belichick saw what the league was this year, saw the identity of his team, and changed his team's identity in November and December, perfected it in January, to prove that and win the Super Bowl.
Yeah, if I saw sports as poetic, and I remember in an earlier episode of Belichick Your Premises, I wanted to explore the characteristics between sport and art. But if I read this as poetic, it is a giant middle finger to Roger Goodell, who has done everything in his power to make this an offense-first, offense-only league. And a Super Tampa Super Bowl 13-3, won by the New England Patriots. You couldn't have written a better metaphorical FU to the commissioner than that.
Oh, yeah, and it was hilarious when he, like, gave his brief, and he kept it as brief as possible, speech about awarding the Patriots the trophy and then handed it off and just like slinked off stage. You could tell he did not want to be there at all.
The best part of the Super Bowl is not the trophy. It's the booing of Roger Goodell.
Yeah.
That is my national pastime. So.
All right. Another question for you guys.
I loved it. Yeah.
It's about the conversation post show. And I think that this is being done because I think the argument, remember years ago, the argument used to be Bill Belichick and Tom Brady aren't the GOATs, and this is why. They aren't the greatest of all time, and this is why. And everyone would say that over and over again. You know, they're system players, and it's a system, and so on and so forth.
Yeah.
System coach, system player. Well, to me, I think this argument has been transferred for Julian Edelman, where everyone, I've seen this so much over the last week. People saying Julian Edelman is not a Hall of Famer. Is Julian Edelman a Hall of Famer? Let me present the case I see here. He is one of the most clutch wide receivers in postseason history. He is the second most postseason catches behind Jerry Rice. He is a Super Bowl MVP. Now, Deion Branch also has a Super Bowl MVP. But look at Deion Branch's postseason career versus Julian Edelman. It's called the Hall of Fame.
Seven wide receivers have ever won Super Bowl MVP or something like that?
Something like that, yes. And one was a kick returner. If you remember, Desmond Howard was the kick returner. Was he a wide receiver? He might have been a defensive back. He was Michigan, wasn't he?
Yeah, he was a wide receiver at Michigan, but he might have moved to defensive back. He was special teams and defensive back, I think, that year.
Okay. Well, so even defensive backs win it even rarer. And a kick returner, it's even more rarely. The point is, though, this is the question I have. Maybe someone can check this on me. There is not a rule that says being in the Hall of Fame, like they don't have a definition for being in the Hall of Fame for saying postseason statistical success, or sorry, preseason, or sorry, regular season statistical success, right? It doesn't say that. There's no rule that says that. So if it's the Hall of Fame and Julian Edelman's won three Super Bowls, has the second most postseason catches behind Jerry Rice, has the insane catch in the Super Bowl comeback, was unstoppable this postseason, where literally it was like, didn't I tell you at halftime, Daniel, we should just change our strategy to throw the ball to Julian Edelman?
Yeah, absolutely. And yeah. It's something that Josh McDaniels has done a couple times this year where nothing is working. And so he just goes, we're going to throw it to Edelman and Gronk. The end.
Yeah. And if that is what he is, isn't he then famous? And doesn't he meet the criteria of Hall of Fame that he's one of the greatest postseason wide receivers ever? Doesn't that warrant being in the Hall of Fame?
Yeah, I think it does. certainly there are other reasons. I mean, certainly people have other greater statistics than Julian Edelman who are not going to be in the Hall of Fame, but winning counts for something to me, and people forget this. Winning it all, winning the big game, being part of the team that wins the big game, that means something because that is the entire point of what you are doing. That is the entire reason you actually play the game. You don't win it to just make the playoff. Or I'm sorry, you don't play it to just make the playoffs. You don't play it just to have a winning record. You don't play it just for personal stats. You play it to win the Super Bowl.
You're telling this to a Lions fan who had to put up with Barry Sanders for, what, 10 years? How long was he most expensive player we had? Could not win, cannot get us to the postseason. But the stats. He's such a good player.
Yeah, exactly. Winning means something. So when you tack on the winning on top of his clutchness, and then also, this isn't something I would necessarily put in there, but he is the first Jewish player to win the Super Bowl MVP.
Is he
Hall
really?
Of Fame. Yes.
Wow, that's funny.
Yeah. All those things together, I think, is clearly means he should be in the Hall of Fame. But a corollary question, do you think he cares? I mean, obviously, Brady will be in the Hall of Fame, but I think Tom Brady would trade another two Super Bowls to never be in the Hall of Fame again, or to never be in the Hall of Fame.
I think he would trade one at this point, because we all know he wants seven to have more as a player than any other franchise.
Yeah.
No, 100%. But, they don't care. They don't care about any of that. I mean, they just like winning. That's what Tom Brady's quote is. We like winning. He doesn't care.
Yeah, Edelman is one of seven wide receivers to ever win Super Bowl MVP. The last time was 2009. That was Santonio Holmes. Others have included Hines Ward in 2006, Deion Branch in 2005, and then it takes a long time. Jerry Rice in 89, and you go back to Fred Biletnikoff and Lynn Swann. So,
aren't they all in the Hall of Fame except for Hines Ward right now?
Yeah, and he will be. It's very rarefied air.
Yeah, there's a huge argument for Hines Ward being in the Hall of Fame. I mean, who defines those two Steelers Super Bowls besides him and Ben Roethlisberger?
Right. Yeah, absolutely. So,
but here's the thing. I agree with you that they don't care, but if there's one thing we can contribute as fans is making sure they are seen as justly as possible by the culture.
I like it.
Speaking of that, The Ringer, also known as the New Grantland, they were like the Borg, right? We destroyed them and they adapted and came back even stronger.
Resistance is futile.
Has an argument putting forward, of course, why we love to hate the Patriots. That's the name of the article. This article takes on the age-old argument of, hey, the Patriots won everything, so let's hate them, and it does it in a more complicated manner. So I'm going to read a couple paragraphs from the end here, and then you guys can respond to it. So let me just... What if we imagine the NFL as a machine for converting one version of football, the local, weird, particular-rooted version, the one that you can experience as part of live reality and not just on TV, into the other version... The Flaming Doritos, this is Sparta Laser Clydesdale.com bullshit one. And what if on some level people feel this and hate it? You can be dazzled by a spectacle and still resent the way it's cheapening something you care about. The internet is doing that to all of us all the time, which is why people who most hate being online are the same people who spend all day on Twitter, but that's a separate column. My point is, if something like that emotional dynamic is operating in football, with a million caveats and footnotes about the slipperiness of authenticity, of course, but this theory is broadly applicable, then which players and teams are least sullied by the process? Who spent the least amount of time in the machine? Underdogs, right? And who spent the most? Winners. Underdogs seem like they have some connection to the world the rest of us live in. It's winners who have had the very nuclei converted into television, and no team in recent sports history has won as relentlessly as the Belichick-Brady Patriots. That's why it was so outrageous when some people around the Patriots tried to position themselves as underdogs during the playoffs. You can be behind per the betting odds. You're not an underdog if your atoms are made of T-Mobile ringtones. And then he goes on just about hating the Patriots. And the irony of what he's saying here, Daniel, and let's see if you agree with me, is this machine he's talking about isn't the whole reason the Patriots win by being outside of it? Isn't that one of Belichick's rules, ignore the noise?
Yeah, they don't participate in it. That's why a lot of football pundits and the football elite hate them, because they won't participate in this ridiculousness. They won't participate in the T-Mobile-ness of it all, whatever the F that means. And if they did, who cares anyway? But the point is, it's a total misrepresentation of reality.
Yeah, they
this article just reads like someone's Zanga, you know, expressing, just pouring out their envy to me. William?
Yeah, this whole, I mean, this is pouring out the envy onto the sort of, like, I guess slightly, like, commercial aspect of it, but the Patriots don't connect to the sports media, right? Like, that's really where this hatred comes from. It sort of drips down from the sports media, and then the general envy that we have in this age of envy, of course, that we've been living in. It just feeds off that envy, right? Like, they aren't part of this sort of, like, whatever is the going trend in football, quote unquote, in the sports media, is usually the opposite of what the Patriots are doing.
Totally. I want to focus a little bit on this line, though, which is, you read it, but I'll reread it. Quote, underdogs seem like they still have some connection to the world the rest of us live in. End quote. Why? Because they're losers and they can't win? Is that why they have a connection to you? Why? Because you feel like in your own life you can't get ahead? You feel like in your own life there are people who are better than you, who accomplish greater things than you, who can outplay you, outclass you, outthink you, outsmart you, outcoach you, etc.? That's why you want to go with the underdogs? Maybe that is true for you, person who reads this article. That is not true for me. I have a much greater connection with folks like the Patriots or other dynasties or other winners, because I also view myself as a winner, someone who wants to accomplish and overcome and win and get what I want and achieve the highest I can in my field. That is the connection I have to the Patriots, that they are heroic. In a certain sense, they are heroic to show me what is possible in a certain realm. I'm not in that realm, but I want to transfer that to my life, to understand that victory is possible, sustained success is possible, greatness is possible in this world. And those who want to tear that down, like the author of this godforsaken article, are truly despicable.
Daniel, that's just your white side speaking. Tell us from the other side.
My other side's napping.
Yeah, that one. You had that one holstered and ready to go. You've said that one before. But no, I want to focus on what you said. The is possible. It's not even like seeing yourself as a winner and winning that much. It's just wanting to know that I put in this hard work, I can succeed, because I see people who put in the ultimate amount of work succeeding on the ultimate scale. And it's very interesting that he's linking it, to go back to what you're saying, to a disconnect from everyday life. Why is he linking winners with television and this sort of mediation, right? Social media is this mediated culture, right? This is, again, a result of that, this Instagram culture. He's like saying that he's basically saying that what the Patriots are doing is only happening in the movies. He's saying it's not real. It's disconnected from the local. But Daniel, you're on the East Coast, and you've been to Gillette Stadium to see Brady play many times now. How many times? Three, four?
Three.
Okay. You've been three times now. My family has had season tickets since 1973. Would you say the Patriots are not local? That they're not, what does he say, the local, weird, particular rooted version that one can experience as part of lived reality? If you go to New England, if you go to Boston in the playoffs, hell, if you go to D.C. in the playoffs, aren't they part of the local, weird, particular rooted version that you experience as part of lived reality?
Of course it is. It's as much of a cultural layer there as food is in certain places. You know, it's inescapable. I told you the story of spending a week in Boston and wearing Patriot stuff around and having to actually stop myself from saying go Pats to everyone I saw in Patriots gear like I do in D.C. because I would literally have to say it to every human being who passed
and
me.
And they would also be like, well, of course, like, what are you talking about, bro?
Exactly. Are they going somewhere? Are they leaving? What are you talking about? Yeah. Yeah.
But so isn't it narcissistic on this author's level that he's completely discounting the experience of, like, fucking people like me?
Of course it is. This whole article is an exercise in narcissism and envy. I mean, just read the last paragraph here, not because it makes any sense, but because it absolutely doesn't make any sense. He says, quote, "But love and reality are strong. I believe that. The Patriots dynasty didn't end this year, and even if it had, it would be replaced by only something equally cynical. Sports isn't about to deserve what we give it. There's hope, though, in the giving. Football is a strange game, and this is a strange country. There are highways where there's darkness." What the F pretentious garbage is that? Hunter Thompson, you are not, sir. E.E. Cummings, you are not, sir. This is a sports column. What kind of garbage are you spewing across the page so you can sound like you have some intellect to bring to this? Actually apply a rational mind to the game, and you can maybe create something that actually is intellectual as opposed to something that sounds intellectual.
Yeah, I don't really understand. Sports isn't about to deserve what we give it. There's hope, though, in the giving. What the fuck am I giving to sports? Besides my
Justin,
money.
Justin,
merchandise.
There are highways where there's darkness.
What does that mean?
Mic drop! Oh my god, the pretentious nature of these people who are like The Ringer and Grantland, who just want to be intellectuals, but they're actually borderline retarded, so they can't be, so they write this crap and try to ruin something that's beautiful like sports. Shut up, TheRinger.com. Shut up, Grantland. May they rest in peace. Etc. Who is this idiot? Brian Phillips? What the hell, Brian Phillips?
Sounds like this guy Daniel's issuing an official The Midside fatwa against TheRinger.com.
Well, we already destroyed Grantland, but then Bill Simmons came back and made The Ringer. And here's the thing to remember about Bill Simmons, is this is the guy who marketed himself as like the Boston sports guy, and then he was the one who was the apologist for Deflategate, remember?
Was he?
Yeah. He's like, I understand why you all hate the Patriots. I understand. It's like, dude, you literally have the moral high ground here and you're giving it up to be liked. Fuck off. And that's ultimately what this is hating the Patriots. And by the way, in this story stream, Julian Edelman is a playoff god. Should he be a Hall of Famer? That's literally on Grantland also. Or on The Ringer also. Yeah, whatever. It's the same thing. No, look, it's the same thing as trying to score as many points for endorphin highs. This is the endorphin high of naturalism. They are just trying to get clicks by making people feel good about themselves. That's all.
Well, I would feel better about myself if I could I could kick this guy in his cis testicles.
Well, I'll make you feel better about yourself by ending this episode. How does that sound?
Yay! No more.
Wow.
My face, your face, instant face. Go talk to whoever you want that does that stuff.
What did we learn this trip, William?
Well, I learned that until I send a unsolicited dick pic, I will not be fully realized.
Was that intentionally obtuse? Because I have no idea what the fuck that means.
It was awesome. I would publish that on TheRinger.com right now.
Daniel?
I learned that Cis Testicle is a great name for an avant-garde metal band. Justin, what did you learn?
I learned that the Super Bowl was boring, Julian Edelman is not a Hall of Famer, and I don't experience the Patriots as a local phenomenon. I'm living a mediated culture and convincing myself they're real when they are not.
Uplifting! If you learned something this week, why don't you let us know all over the social medias at The Midside. That's Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, Snapchat, Vero, and anywhere else those goods are sold. You can go to themidside.com/podcast and listen to all the past episodes of Welcome to The Midside. All 6 seasons of the show as we enter the 7th season here. The 7th season does sound like a book by James Patterson or something, right? But it's going to be wonderful. You can also go to themidside.com/store and pick up your Welcome to the Midside merch. And you can go to iTunes, or maybe it's called Apple Podcasts now, and Google Play and give us a 5-star review that helps us crawl our way up the rankings past shows like The Ringer and Welcome to Night Vale and all the other posers out there. We've already decimated Grantland, so forget those people. And you can go to patreon.com/themidside or themidside.com/patreon and choose to give us a few bucks every time we do the show. It's greatly appreciated. As I said at the beginning, it helps us keep the lights on, which we do. We love lights. I'm sitting here with a light on, thanks to Patreon. But it does help us pay for hosting and expenses for the show, so we greatly appreciate our Patreon subscribers. Thanks to Liberty.me for syndicating us. But if you can't give us money, that's fine. We know money's tight in Trump's economy. So why don't you tell a friend about the show? Did you just hear an epic sports rant from Justin or William or myself that you really want someone to hear? Why don't you forward the show on to them? Folks like @MotivePower on Twitter, thanks for sharing. And we thank everyone who shares the show, but it's the thing you can do that helps us more than anything else, because we want others to witness the farce alongside us here in the Midside. Until next week, thanks for tuning in. We love you.
This concludes your journey into the Midside. I'm Justin M. Lesneski reminding you that if things get tough, take a step back and witness the farce.
Have a day.
Well, I don't need to send you Belichick your premises unless we want to start talking about the American Alliance of Football.
I'm going to watch it tonight.
What do you mean? I watched it last night. Orlando winning 40-6. That's right.